What is that special thing that makes us human? The spark that led early humans to make art and to innovate in the creation of tools. Is it scientifically identifiable? Well, those are some of the questions that Alan Alda asks in a PBS series called The Human Spark, which is being aired on the next two Wednesdays at 8 p.m. It gives me great pleasure to welcome Alan Alda back to our show today.
Thank you. It's fun to talk with you again.
And you've been here to talk about roles you've played, including scientists, and also about your interest in science. Did one connect to you to the other?
Certainly when that time when I spoke with you about the play QED, where mm-hmm. I played the great physicist Richard Feynman. That had come about, that production came about, because of my interest in science. I took a book about Feynman to Gordon Davidson at the Center Theater Group in California, in Los Angeles. And they said, do you think we could make a play out of this? And he had known Feynman and was very interested in Feynman. And we asked Peter Parnell to write the play. And we thought we'd have it on the stage about a year later. And it took us 6 years to get that play ready to show it to an audience. Not because there was anything lacking in Peter Parnell. He's a great playwright. But the character is so complex. Mm-hmm. Feynman's character, he was so many different people. It was very hard to pin down.
An admirable scientist, but not always an admirable person.
Well, he was human. And he had a couple of flaws, but they were... I think he got blamed more for not being aware of the changing times than for who he was.
Mm. Well, I often in shows of this sort, when an actor winds up being the presenter of a scientific show, we have the sense that it was all scripted for him. But I had the sense here that most of these questions were occurring to you.
Well, they all were. Yeah. Well, you know what we try to do? And we learned how to do this on the series called Scientific American Frontiers that we did on PBS for 11 years. And what I found in the beginning, it's funny, it'd be fun to trade ideas with you about interviewing, because you've done this for 25 years now.
Well, at this station, I started earlier.
Probably a lot earlier than that. But what I found was I would, in the beginning of that 11-year stint on Scientific American Frontiers. In the beginning, I wanted to read as much as I could written by the people I was interviewing. And what I went in doing was being only half-informed or partially informed. And I would ask them questions that would create this strange look on their faces. And I didn't know why they looked so uncomfortable at first. And I realized finally, especially in one interview with Carl Sagan, where I was boxing him in with my questions and I wasn't giving him a chance to tell me what he really knew, because the question limited him so mm-hmm. much to what I thought he knew. So after that, I stopped preparing so much and listened more. And I would ask very basic questions because I'm very curious about it. I have a certain, from general reading, I have a smattering of knowledge about what they're up to generally, but I don't really understand what each specific. But these people they've spent their lives on this, so I can't be prepared enough to know what they did in a couple of days.
Too often, when people write questions for an interview, they will ask, "Is it this or is it that?"
Yes,
as though there are two alternatives. And of course, the scientist may have a totally different idea.
Of course, yeah. Well, and on the spur of the moment, you often think, "Well, if it's not this, it must be that." But the 50 years or so that they've put into this subject has led to a lot of other possibilities.
So after Charles Darwin proposed that humans are descended from apes or whatever he did, and therefore are also animals, and scientists embraced the ideas of evolution, when did they begin to try to find out what makes us different from all the other animal species?
I don't know what the history of that question is, but I have a feeling they've been trying to figure it out from the very beginning. On this program called The Human Spark, we went around the world, at least we went to several continents, trying to find out what the general feeling was. And there were some differences of opinion. There are some scientists, for instance, who focus on how similar we are to our cousins, the chimps. And, we're only a percent and a half or something like that different from them in terms of our DNA. But that's an important percentage.
Vive la difference.
Yeah, it's a very, I mean, we think there's a tremendous difference. I don't know if the chimps are getting together and saying, boy, they think they're pretty good, don't they? But there, some scientists focus on how close we are to them, and others focus on the enormity of the differences.
Well, you spend a lot of time talking about beings that no longer exist, Neanderthals.
Yeah.
They were even closer to us. And judging from the models that have been made from their skeletons, they look very much like us.
In fact,
the one that you have in the show does not have that big brow with the big eyebrows that we usually see that make them look so much stupider than they may have been.
The guy in the show looked just awfully confused, like what happened to me? But what, you know,
he looks like somebody I saw in the subway last week.
I used to have some relatives, but the thing that really interested me was this conversation I had. If you saw the first show last week, we were out in a town square having lunch, and I was talking with Randy White, the scientist from NYU, and he really brought things together for me about the Neanderthals and us, because I said, the scientists have been telling me how we and the Neanderthals came from a common ancestor in Africa. And at one point, a bunch of us took this long trek and over thousands of years wound up in Europe, where those people became what we call the Neanderthals, but they didn't seem to evolve much or progress much after that. Whereas those of us who stayed behind did evolve. And then when we went up north and went got into the same land in Europe, all of a sudden we had all these other tools and we could adapt to the environment. What's the difference, I asked him? Why did we have that and they didn't, and yet we came from the same people?
And then the Neanderthals died out.
And why did they die out? And it wasn't because we killed them. They don't see any evidence of our murdering them.
Well, what about competing with us?
Well, we out-competed them for resources, apparently. But he said this such an interesting thing. He said, we managed to hang on and progress so much because we had this ability with technology. We kept making improvements on our tools, whereas they used pretty much the same tool for a couple of 100,000 years. They didn't change it.
Now, we look at their DNA. First of all, how do we access their DNA? We only have fossil record, don't we?
Yeah, and I think the DNA doesn't last very long, and it gets easily corrupted.
During the show, you have people really cover it up so that none of their DNA accidentally winds up in the mix.
Right. So they drill into bones and they get the powder out and they get some DNA from that, and apparently enough to be able to really see how, you know, what their DNA fingerprint is.
And I would assume that they are even closer to us than the chimps, who
are
98 and a half.
Yeah, I think they are. And one of the critical differences between us and them seems to be, at least they're able to extrapolate out from what they find, one of the critical differences seems to be this sociability we have. And when Randy White at that lunch in the middle of the square said to me, we were able to make technological advances. And I said, but everybody's telling me that it's the sociability, our ability to cooperate, you know, to hunt together, even to live together in a community. And he said, yeah, but you can't have one without the other. And then suddenly it clicked for me, because let's say you had a genius Neanderthal in a cave somewhere, or a rock shelter, who figured out an improvement on the tools they used. If he didn't have what we have, which is the ability to teach one another, to transfer it, to pick up on what the other people are doing with this avid attitude we have toward one another, then that genius's improvement would just die with him.
Do we know if they even were capable of language?
We don't know. We don't know, but I have talked to scientists who have said that the kind of hunting tools they devised would have required cooperation and strategy and planning of a kind that you could probably only get if you had some kind of language, or a language very close to what you and I are experiencing now.
Now, their numbers were very small, even though they had all of Europe as a place to live.
They were spread out. But this, one estimate I heard was 10 to 20,000 Neanderthals spread all over Europe, which is maybe another important reason why they couldn't spread technological advances. If one little clan of 30 people or so is isolated hundreds of miles from another clan, then their improvements, their technological advances may just perish.
They also lasted in Europe for 200,000 years. You would have thought that they would have had more connections to each other. Yeah. They did engage in hunting in groups and things of that sort, so they must have looked very much like Homo sapiens.
And that, you know, what you just brought up really came home to me during while we were shooting that series. They probably did have hunting cooperation of some kind. And then when you think that there are hyenas, I think, that cooperate in hunting.
Wolves do.
Yeah. There's this continuum of behavior that maybe blossoms with us, but it's not unknown in the other animals. And one of the things that I really took away from this was my consanguinity with the other animals, that it's not like there's us and then bang, on the other side of the wall is them. We're along a path.
I just saw a documentary that suggests that elephants have a lot of language of a sort. They really understand each other. We don't know much of it because it's on such low tones that we don't even hear it unless we record it.
Yeah.
But I would assume that the Neanderthals had something, as you say, so that they could do these things, or at least grunts or whatever. But what they didn't do is create art. They didn't advance in the tool making.
Right. They didn't seem to have, as far as art was concerned, a sense of the symbol that we had. I mean, one of the scientists I talked with, which was on last week's show, had to do with how important it was to find all these beads that the early humans made, the modern humans, because those beads represented the status in the community. And others, they worked as other kinds of symbols. And when you have that kind of symbolic thinking, that can get you way farther along than a couple of grunts can.
And we also learned from the beads that there was trade.
Yes.
Because some of the beads come from far away.
Right.
We'll take a little break and we'll come back with more of my conversation with Alan Alda, who is hosting a PBS series called The Human Spark. He seems to be having a lot of fun during the shows.
I am.
First this. We're back with Alan Alda. He's hosting a series called The Human Spark, which is being presented on PBS here locally on Channel 13 at 8 p.m. on Wednesdays. The first show was already on, and now we have two more to go?
Right, yes.
Because I only saw the first one on the Neanderthals. That's why I was spending a lot of time. Although I was totally fascinated by this important thing, which is our DNA is so similar, and there is something that allowed us to be what we are, maybe not always the best thing for the planet, but still here we are.
I wonder how long we'll last. I always ask that at the dinner table. The average lifespan of a species is about 2 million years, I've read. So do we have any hope as a species of being average?
Well, we're doing everything possible to destroy the planet, and that's part of the human spark as well.
I guess
it
is. The
technology has been both a positive and a negative.
Yeah.
And the technology that allowed us to hunt well has led to the extinction of many species. It led to there being no horses in the Americas where they began.
It's as though we have a drive that just can't be stopped to invent, which is glorious. I just find it so fascinating to talk with scientists who are constantly inventing things and discovering insights into nature based on the tiniest bits of information, which is the use of imagination in another way. But that very imagination, that very inventiveness, is something we have to learn to outlive.
How long did Neanderthals exist on Earth?
I can't tell you for sure, but it was over 250,000 years.
Yeah, they were in Europe for about 200,000 years. Obviously they left Africa and went into Europe. How long before humans started, before Cro-Magnon started doing the things that you associate with that human spark?
They got to Europe apparently 30 or 35,000 years ago, or maybe a little bit more than that.
So we've been around a long time before we started making art and doing all the other things.
Yeah.
Maybe the Neanderthals just didn't have enough time.
Oh, they had plenty of time. They had plenty of time, and they never changed from that. Basically, never changed from that simple hand axe, which they worked with two hands. It was a big rock that came to a point. But we came, by the time we got there, and the Crow, it's interesting, they don't seem to call them Cro-Magnons anymore. They call them modern humans because that Cro-Magnon refers to the spot where they first found a modern human, and now they found them all over the place.
I just saw signs in the film on your show.
Yeah, it was
that
a Cro-Magnon.
Cro-Magnon
Hotel, and I think it was behind that hotel they found one of the first ones.
The rooms are all caves, by the way.
That's hot and cold running Neanderthals. So the interesting thing about the second show is to figure out not what we came from, the group that the common ancestor we had with the Neanderthal, but then to try to explore more on the second show this coming Wednesday night. How different are we from our cousins, the other primates? And there are some surprising similarities and yet some very, very severe differences, apparently.
Well, I remember seeing films from the old days where scientists would take a baby chimp and bring it up with their own child. And the chimp would develop much quicker than the human infant.
I think I've heard that from scientists that for the first 3 years they're very similar. And then the humans really take off. Even the ones they've done things where they've tried to teach chimps sign language and then put the chimp in with other chimps expecting that they'd all be talking sign language soon. And I don't think that was very successful.
They don't pass on language to the other chimps.
There's a very interesting comparison between the chimps and the way they learn and the way humans, the way we learn. You'll see the mother chimp allow the baby to get his or her face right in on the activity that the mother chimp is engaged in, and she'll be like perhaps sticking a twig in a tree trying to get ants out, and his face is right in there and he's observing, and then he'll copy her. She makes, as far as anybody can tell, she makes no effort to teach him. She just tolerates him. Whereas our pattern is very different. We look each other in the eye and we want to know if you're getting it, and we go over it a few times. We take your hands in ours and we model your hands. It's very, very different. Actual teaching is taking place with us.
But something similar does occur among chimps because in recent years we've learned that they actually invent tools. And that chimp groups will then continue to use those tools that other chimp groups know nothing about.
That's right. Yeah. In fact, if we on the next week's show, there's this very interesting experiment where a chimp figures out how to open up a door on a box and get a treat out. And everybody in that chimp's group does it that way. Mm-hmm. The other group does it the way the head chimp does it over there, and they don't seem to experiment that much.
What did you learn about the experience of empathy amongst humans and chimps?
I think it's a lot more prevalent among humans, from what I've been able to tell. Franz de Waal said to me at one point, he's a great chimp researcher. He said, and he, by the way, has devoted a career to exploring the ways in which we're very much alike. But he said, in New York, you have 10 million people. If you had 10 million chimps instead, you'd have a bloodbath.
Even with the bonobos, who often do things to quell
well,
tensions.
They use sex.
But they still do have, it turns out, they still do violent things quite a bit.
If you had 10 million bonobos in New York, you couldn't get into Plato's Retreat.
Well, you know, that wouldn't be the worst thing in the world, would it?
I don't know. I've never been there.
Do you have a gift card? Bonobos would say, make love, not war.
Although they probably actually say,
make love and war.
It really is interesting that how they have this little offshoot of animal life has solved an awful lot of problems that way. I suppose they may have created some, too. You'd think there'd be a lot more bonobos, wouldn't you?
Well, you'd think that they'd be smiling more anyway. Alan Alda is the host of a series on PBS called The Human Spark, and it airs on Wednesdays at 8 o'clock. We talked a bit about jewelry and the symbolism of jewelry. Do we have any sense of when humans started thinking of decorating themselves? Because no other animals do that.
Decorating themselves would include painting themselves. Yeah. Did painting come first? I think it might have. There's a really interesting woman studying this in parts of Africa where she thinks she may have found looks like a rock, but it may be some kind of coloring material that they might have decorated themselves with. It that would have predated shells and beads and that kind of thing by a lot. I don't know by how much. I'm very reluctant to give dates and numbers because I don't want to misspeak.
But this is pigmentation.
Some kind of pigmentation. Mm-hmm. Yeah, but they were doing things a very long time ago, longer ago than the Lascaux paintings in France. In Africa, earlier than that, they were making shells. They were putting holes in shells so they could string them. So there's been a lot of ornamentation that goes back quite a while. Now, the question is, does that really indicate a big shift in culture? Where does it indicate a greater sense? Does it indicate language in some way? The awful thing about language is it leaves no fossils. Mm-hmm. You know, the word you utter a word and it goes into the air and that's it.
Until it's written, and that was a long time later.
Way long time later.
Well, do we have any sense of how different life was for those early humans in Africa and in Europe? Did the challenges of Europe force those humans to come up with things that the Africans didn't have to worry about because there was an abundance of food and
produce? I don't know. You know, the interesting thing about the work many of the scientists we talk to shows that the old idea that modern humans sprang up in Europe is perhaps an outmoded idea. I don't think perhaps. I think it's getting to be pretty definite now.
Since Europeans come up with these theories.
Yeah, well, the Europeans dig around in their own backyard and they say, look, we got human in our backyard. When in fact, apparently it was what I was trying to describe before. We came from a common ancestor. Some of us went up to Europe and became what we call Neanderthals, whereas we stayed in Africa, and down there in Africa, we progressed and we got this ability to make better tools and we had a better social culture and that kind of thing. So when we got to Europe, we were ready to take over. We were already modern humans.
Did no Neanderthals stay in Africa?
Well, some the ones who stayed in Africa became us, as far as I can make out, or maybe they kept their their cultural modesty and died out in Africa along with the ones up there. I don't know if they found any remains of people they would call Neanderthals in Africa.
Well, they had to be different enough so that scientists today believe that there was no interspecies.
They're pretty sure there was no, there were no descendants from them. There might have been some. They might have had a couple of affairs, but they it didn't lead to too much. And they and
I think I saw that movie.
They don't. I think Seth Rogen was in that. They don't. I don't think. I don't think that they found any evidence. In fact, I was told that there's no evidence of warfare between them. Only that we somehow, as you said, outcompeted them.
Right, by killing more animals more
efficiently. I think that they had a limited diet. You know what was so amazing was that
they look at teeth, don't they? Can't they tell?
They look at the teeth and they can tell what they ate from the, an analysis of their teeth, and they can see how long the childhood was, which is a real mark of modern humans, because we develop outside the womb to a great extent. But they don't if we killed off their main food supply, then because we were good at hunting, I would imagine that would have really hurt their chances.
In the final part of the series, you take a look inside human brains.
Yeah. Mainly inside my own.
Which, did they find that human spark in you?
They, you know what? I think they tell this to all the boys. They told me I had a nice-looking brain, and that there's a big hole in everybody's brain right around the center, and it gets bigger as you get older. And mine apparently hadn't gotten that big yet. So they like to flatter your brain. They keep you in that machine for about an hour, and I think they want to reward you when you come out. I actually got a terrible anxiety attack in the machine. It was like being slipped into a narrow tube. And they forgot to give me that little rubber bulb that you squeeze in case you're in trouble. And as soon as I got inside and they realized they didn't have the bulb, I got anxious about not having the bulb.
But when they look at a human brain and then a chimp's brain and something creative is thought of by the human, does an area of the brain light up that doesn't light up in the chimp's brain?
I'm not so sure they can that it's easy for them to do functional MRIs with chimps, which is really what you're describing. You can do a regular MRI where you find out where all the parts of the brain are
and
how big they are,
or something, and see what lights up.
But you can't. A functional MRI allows you to look at the brain while the person is conscious and thinking of something or doing something. And I don't think you can keep the chimp still enough for that, although they may be able to do it in some cases.
Was there anything about your brain that surprised you?
Well, I was glad that hole wasn't big enough.
Well, that's the hole that all of my memories seem to be falling into recently.
And I was told once by a brain researcher that I had a plump hippocampus, which made me feel just great.
A plump hippocampus would mean that you have a large area for processing.
I can make new memories pretty well.
So what happens after this series is over? Are you going to continue this pursuit?
Oh, I can't not. I mean, I'm crazy about science. To me, it's a great detective story, and I'm, you know, we may have talked with you about the World Science Festival, which we have every summer now.
The next time you come by. Meanwhile, we can see these shows on Wednesdays at 8 p.m. My great thanks to Alan Alda for talking about the human spark on PBS.
Thank you.